This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, look over there. Yeah, it's the news that's not always in the news. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 6th of March. Good, as it always is, to have you along, everybody. We're going to start where we ended on Friday. The idea that the pace of the news the past 5 weeks or so has been steady, shall we say. Relentless, others might say. This past weekend was no exception, with the president's unsubstantiated claims that President Obama wiretapped him at Trump Tower during the campaign. We, however, are not going to talk about those tweets. We're just going to use them as a jumping off point for a new series we're starting today with the working title, Squirrel. That is, the idea that the president is redirecting everybody's attention with his tweets so as to distract from news perhaps less favorable to him. Today's examples, the well-off-the-pace hiring in the executive branch of the 1,100 or so Senate-confirmed positions the president of the United States has to fill. President Trump has nominated people to just 35 of them. That is according to a handy-dandy tracker from the Washington Post and the Partnership for Public Service. The president has said some of those vacancies are intentional, but they do include several deputy secretaries and undersecretaries, jobs that are key to carrying out his agenda. So Marketplace's Amy Scott gets us going with what that power vacuum might mean for the business of actually governing.
Think of the deputy secretary as a sort of chief operating officer. Terry Girton is CEO of the nonprofit National Academy of Public Administration. Without a second in command, she says,
you have folks at the top with a very particular agenda, but with no way to force that agenda down into the organization.
There are acting deputies in place at Homeland Security and the Pentagon and Treasury Department, but Max Steyer with the Partnership for Public Service likens them to substitute teachers.
They may be terrific teachers, but since they aren't going to be there for the full year, they're not perceived as having real authority, and they don't often act as if they do.
There are several reasons for the delay, says political science professor Grant Reher at Syracuse University. One, he says, is an issue of supply.
A lot of prominent Republicans, the usual suspects, either, I think, are not interested or they were critical of the Trump campaign, and so therefore they're not being looked at.
But Rachel Bovard with the Conservative Heritage Foundation blames Democrats for holding up the confirmation process.
The longer it takes for these guys to be confirmed, the longer it takes for the agencies to be staffed up. I mean, it sort of follows logically that you can't hire the underlings until you have the boss in place.
It's not clear how many underlings Trump even plans to hire. In an interview with Fox News last week, the president called hundreds and hundreds of jobs in the federal government, in his words, totally unnecessary. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The president's new executive order on travel restrictions to this country that he signed this morning has noticeably removed Iraq from the list of affected countries. There are now six on that list, not seven. Rami Rahayem is correspondent for the BBC. We got him via Skype in Erbil. That's up in northern Iraq. Thanks for coming on the program.
Hello. Nice to speak to you.
You were up in Mosul over the weekend. Tell me what it's like up there in the parts of that city that have been liberated, I guess.
We got to Kokhjali, this neighborhood. Life appears to be coming back slowly. We saw a marketplace. People were selling CDs, music CDs. They were also complaining about the services in the city, especially about water. Huh. And the main pipe, water pipes have been broken, damaged during the fighting. So the eastern part now, which is under Iraqi government control, is in very urgent need of a solution for the water problem.
You said before we turn the microphones on that you had been to several camps for internally displaced persons. What's that like? What did you see there?
Well, the one I went to a couple of days ago on Saturday is called Hammam al-Alil. This is an area just south of Mosul. and the numbers are staggering. We're talking possibly 10,000 a day during the past few days. We're also talking about 50,000 since the battle for Western Mosul started last month, but probably more than half of that just in the last few days. So we're talking a sudden upsurge as the battle intensifies for Western Mosul. With such a situation, the authorities as well as NGOs are struggling to provide for these people coming out. And then they have to move them from the camp, which is now at full capacity, to other camps closer to Erbil, for example, which have been established for much longer and where conditions are much better.
I'm not sure if you've heard the news from the States this morning, the new travel executive order that's out from the president and taking Iraq off that list. Part of the reason he said was because Iraq is a partner with the United States in operations like Mosul. What is the perspective, do you think, of the people up there who are actually dealing with it on this travel ban and the way the Trump administration has been going about it?
Well, it's all been quite messy and chaotic. I'm sure I don't need to tell you. But in terms of Iraq, it's even more complicated. You've got many people working with the Iraqi government from the American army. So you have a very close relationship, a military relationship between Iraq, the government of Iraq, and the government of the United States. I think that's the number one complicating factor. It just doesn't look good. But right now, the immediate reaction to the news coming out today was one of relief. The Iraqi foreign ministry said that this is a very welcome step and it will safeguard what they call the strategic relationship between the two countries.
Rami, thanks so much. That's Rami Rahim, the BBC Arabic correspondent. We got him in Erbil, Iraq.
Thank you. Pleasure.
On Wall Street today, traders were a bit off their feed, it seems. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Corporate story of the day is brought to us by the letters G and M. General Motors is selling its two European car brands, Vauxhall and Opel, to a French car maker called PSA Group. They own Peugeot and Citroën. $2 billion is the on-the-barrelhead sale price, plus another $4 billion in pension and retirement obligations. Marketplace's Bree Benishore has more now on why GM is throwing in the European towel.
You know that old saying, doing the same thing again and again, expecting a different outcome is the definition of insanity? Well, GM decided to stop being crazy.
GM has lost money in Europe for nearly two decades now.
Bernard Zwicky is senior automotive analyst at the Center for Automotive Research.
And over that time, they've lost about $20 billion.
GM has not made money in Europe once in the 21st century. It thought it might last year, and then Brexit happened, messed with the exchange rates, and threw GM's profits off.
It's just very hard to make money in Europe.
David Whiston is automotive analyst at Morningstar.
The problem with Europe is that it's an extremely crowded marketplace. Volkswagen has about a quarter of it alone.
You've got Renault and Peugeot and even Toyota and Honda and Ford, a Czech brand called Skoda.
And it's really tough to get scale there.
Whiston says dealing with organized labor in Europe was an especially big challenge for GM, so it threw in the towel. But where is it throwing the towel to? Roger Lanto is with Strategy Analytics.
Most of the growth opportunities are in emerging markets, so Asia and Southeast Asia.
And there is a hot trend to tend to in the United States, gas-guzzling SUVs and trucks, a trend that could get hotter because the federal government intends to roll back regulations on fuel efficiency.
The vehicles are selling, and they're accounting for more than 60% of the market right now, and it's hard to argue with that. You can't really swim against a tide that is so overwhelming.
The risk there is, of course, if gas prices rise. That's a dance, Lanto says, that automakers are always doing, though. GM's dance floor is just no longer in Europe. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
While Congress and the rest of us wait for President Trump's actual budget proposal, the one with the details about his spending plan, not just the outline that came out last week, some elements have begun to trickle down. Among them, the EPA perhaps losing as much as a quarter of its budget. And the energy and environmental trade publication E&E News says that one of the EPA's better-known programs, Energy Star, the one with those labels on the appliances, could be cut as well. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that story.
Take a look at your computer monitor or washing machine or refrigerator. Is there a blue symbol with a white star? That means it's among the top performers in its field when it comes to energy efficiency. Billy Pizer, who teaches public policy at Duke University, says the program's voluntary.
Companies don't have to do it, but when you go shopping in the store and you see some Energy Star products and some non-Energy Star products, your mind immediately begins to think, well, maybe the Energy Star products are better.
The program is widely seen as a success for pushing innovation when it comes to energy use. The Obama administration said it saves consumers $34 billion a year in energy costs. But early Trump administration budget reports say this is something that could be done by the private sector instead. Pizer says that could hurt its credibility.
It's not quite clear what industry association or, you know, what nonprofit would actually have the resources to think about it as broadly as the government does right now.
Doug Johnson with the Consumer Technology Association says the program hasn't been perfect. He cites increased costs for manufacturers seeking that label due to testing requirements. Johnson says there are other avenues for the private sector to push energy efficiency.
We continue to support advanced energy efficiency in different ways, and we know at the heart of everything is innovation. Innovation will drive efficiency, whether or not there is an Energy Star program out there.
The EPA, which manages the program, declined to comment, saying it's still early in the process, and any budget plans must be approved by Congress. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Johnson & Johnson got a legal win in St. Louis last week. The health and consumer products company prevailed in a case involving its baby powder as a potential cause of ovarian cancer. J&J had lost three previous suits along the same line, also in St. Louis, which has put that city in the spotlight for what's called tort reform, changes that would make it harder for people to sue companies. From St. Louis Public Radio, Maria Altman reports.
In the last year or so, you may have caught one of those legal TV ads talking about talcum powder and ovarian cancer.
If you or a loved one used talcum powder and were diagnosed with ovarian cancer, you may be entitled to substantial compensation. We can help.
This ad was from the Onder law firm in St. Louis, which brought three lawsuits against healthcare giant Johnson & Johnson last year and won. St. Louis juries awarded nearly $200 million in damages. Lawyer Jim Onder, who helped win those awards, says it's no surprise that the business-backed American Tort Reform Association is critical of St. Louis as a result.
It has nothing to do with the law, the judges, the juries.
Onder says the group takes a one-sided view.
And they ignore the fact that big verdicts are a function of egregious, horrible conduct in disregard of human life.
The American Tort Reform Association counters that St. Louis has been on its watch list for a while. Spokesman Darren McKinney says plaintiffs' attorneys in Missouri are able to game the system.
You know, what's going on in Missouri, it's not the case of a couple of large but otherwise just verdicts. It's a system where a lax standard of expert evidence, where lax venue laws let out-of-state plaintiffs shop their cases to friendly St. Louis judges.
McKinney says Missouri should raise the bar on who can be considered an expert witness by adopting a standard used by the federal courts. It allows hearings to be held on whether someone is qualified to give expert testimony. Missouri's venue law allows people from out of state to join other plaintiffs who allege their victims, as long as they bundle their suit with a local plaintiff. In the Johnson & Johnson cases, for instance, the three lead plaintiffs in the suit were all from out of state. Up to 99 people can sue as a group, and that can cut down on legal costs, but McKinney says it's not fair.
They ought to be bringing their cases where they live.
Missouri's new governor, Eric Greitens, agrees. The Republican talked specifically about the judicial hellhole ranking in his first State of the State address. He says Missouri's civil judicial system is hurting the state's ability to attract businesses.
For too long in this state, trial lawyers have picked our people's pockets, and it's time to do different. It's time to do different.
Missouri's Republican-led House and Senate have eagerly taken up the governor's suggestions. Legislators have introduced bills to change the state's venue rule and toughen expert witness standards. But others say Missouri's current system is fair. Thomas Stewart is a law professor at St. Louis University. He says product liability cases are filed in St. Louis because the circuit's judges are known for their expertise and efficiency.
St. Louis litigated tobacco cases, and those tobacco cases resulted in defense verdicts.
In other words, in favor of the tobacco companies.
Why didn't we get the judicial hellhole designation when that happened?
Stewart says the reforms being proposed will just mean additional hurdles for those who may have been harmed by a company's product. In St. Louis, I'm Maria Altman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That loyalty kind of kicked in, and it really didn't work very well at all.
What's in a name? Well, a lot, as it turns out. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 51 points today, about 0.25%, 20,954. The NASDAQ down 21 points, 0.33%, 5849. The S&P 500 slipped 7 points, also 0.33%, 2375. Told you earlier, GM is saying bye-bye to Europe. Investors revved up GM share price when the talks were announced last month. Today, not so much. Shares down 0.8%. Airline stocks hit some turbulence today. Delta lowered its performance estimates. Shares dropped 2.5%. Same for United Continental, fell 3.25%. Bond prices fell today. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.49%. And you? Yes, you. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. Me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I went up to San Francisco a couple of weeks ago for an interview with Steve Huffman, one of the co-founders and the CEO of Reddit. Actually, what happened was that I met Molly Wood up there, and we talked to him together for the new podcast that Molly and I are working on called Make Me Smart. So I thought what we would do today is each of us would pick a clip from that interview, play it, and then we would talk about it for a bit. All right. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So here's my piece of tape. It was I had asked him, given all that is going on in this country and how much of it is going on social media, where sort of Reddit has to think about drawing the line at where their role is, where the tech industry's role is in sort of this democracy. And here he is, Steve Huffman, the CEO and one of the co-founders of Reddit.
I think all of us as Americans are obligated to stand up for the things that we believe in. And it's always a little tricky when you're trying to balance like your personal beliefs, like my personal beliefs, versus that of the company that I lead and that of the communities that Reddit represents. But I think when there are areas of direct conflicts, we should say something. So, for example, on the immigration fiasco a couple weeks ago, that was an easy one for us, right? My co-founder grew up in an immigrant family. We employ lots of immigrants here. The tech industry in general does. We depend on worldwide talent to be competitive. And so those are things that are a direct threat to not only our values, but also to our business. And so those are easy ones.
So what I thought was interesting about that was the disclaimer he made right up at the top versus his beliefs versus the company he stands for and realizing that he represents a constituency, but also that tech and Reddit and all the rest of them have a huge role to play in how things are perceived in this economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that they are trying to thread the needle in many of the same ways that they're trying to thread the needle with the content on the site.
Right.
The thing that I, my favorite thing coming out of it, I'm not going to call it a piece of tape because I know we're going to get email about that. My favorite piece of digital recording coming out of that interview was one that I just find fantastic about the Valley in general. And it was a conversation about Reddit's brand and whether it exists and why it doesn't. And here is his answer on that.
We were just going with the flow. Every day we built what was fun for us, what we thought would be fun for the users. And so it was a good thing in the sense that Reddit came from a very pure place of let's just build something that people want. But it was a bad thing in that we didn't know where we were going. And so our evolution as a business was delayed as a result.
Okay, this is just like an amazing thing about Silicon Valley, but which is that you could be building what you claim is a business, but have no business plan whatsoever. And I think it is interesting in the context of everything that Reddit has become, in the context of what Twitter is, in the context of Medium, Blogger, you know, all of these kind of publishing platforms that are an attempt to corral conversation online, but then also eventually come with some pressure to make money. And then that pressure to make money is what causes Steve Huffman to have to so carefully consider, you know, the problems of harassment and offensive speech. Yep. And when that offensive speech crosses over into the real world, it's kind of like Reddit is the only business that could ever spring up if you were never planning to make it a business.
Well, look no farther, actually, just to bring it to present day. Snapchat, company loses $500-something million a year, and its stock is going through the roof, although not today. I mean, it's amazing that folks start these companies and go, oh, yeah, wait, we got to make money at this?
Exactly. You know? The people will come. The money, hopefully.
Maybe not. Anyway, listen to the whole interview. It's on our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart. There is also Steve Huffman's answer to what we are calling the Make Me Smart question, which goes like this. What is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about? And Huffman has, I think Molly and I agree, right, that it is the best answer to that question ever?
Oh, yeah. It is a doozy. And so we're not even going to tell you here. You have to go listen to it yourself.
That's true. And you can do that, by the way, on the actual podcast itself. You can find it marketplace.org/makemesmart. Thank you, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
Every now and then on this program, we take a minute and we turn it over basically to you. Your questions, our answers about this or that bewildering topic in business and the economy. It's a segment we call I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Today, this, it's from Tom Cronin in Atlanta, Georgia.
So I grew up in California. About 5 years ago, I moved to Georgia, and I saw a lot of the same logos for, you know, ice cream and bread and restaurants, but they had different brand names. Why would they do that?
Annie Baxter's got the answer.
The answer to our listener's question begins with a hamburger run.
All natural or thick burger patty, Jed?
Lady's choice.
That's me and my fellow reporter Jed Kim ordering dinner together, or really ordering dinner at the same time in different parts of the country. I'm in Minnesota at a restaurant chain that goes by one name east of the Rocky Mountains, and Jed is in California at the version of the chain that goes by another name in his neck of the woods.
How's the weather over there?
It's lovely. Probably in the 60s.
We're trying to figure out the extent to which the Carl's Jr. restaurant he's visiting is more or less the same as the Hardee's I'm in. The two places have the same logo, a little smiling star, and maybe you've seen some of the ads that end with both restaurants' names.
And you have a wonderful night.
You too.
Jed and I get our burgers, then we FaceTime and compare notes. The burgers are basically the same, except Jed scored a lot more cheese on his.
I mean, look at that. That is a lot of cheese. It's pretty exciting.
But a lot on the menu is the same. So why maintain separate brands? Turns out that was not part of the original plan.
There were initial attempts to try to convert Hardee's to Carl's Jr.
Brad Haley is chief marketing officer of CKE. It's the parent company of the two restaurants. Haley says Hardee's customers rejected attempts to rebrand their local restaurants as Carl's Jr. back when CKE acquired Hardee's 20 years ago.
And that loyalty kind of kicked in, and it really didn't work very well at all. Sales declined pretty significantly.
Most of the restaurants that converted to the Carl's Jr. name got switched back to Hardee's, and they've kept the two brands running separately ever since. Hardee's customer Warren Weber is the kind of person those moves catered to. He says he's tried Carl's Jr. in Colorado and says it's fine.
They're pretty much the same.
But he prefers Hardee's.
We like this one the best.
His scientific reason?
Because we come here all the time.
There are other examples. The mayos marketed under either Hellman's or Best Foods, depending on where you are in the country, they're also mostly the same. Jitender Batra at the consulting firm Alex Partners says food companies can't afford to lose customers when there's a brand change because they have notoriously thin profit margins.
In food, they are roughly half of the average margin for other consumer products. And so they have less money to advertise and also less risk they can take in terms of potential erosion in sales.
He says it is more expensive to run two separate brands, but that's better than losing gobs of customers.
I managed to get bacon, cheese,
everything into one bite.
Back at my virtual dinner with my colleague Jed Kim, I finish up my burger at Hardee's. He takes his last bites at Carl's Jr.
I think we should do this every time we go out for food.
Oh, yeah. I'm just going to call you up.
Maybe next time we'll compare notes on regional mayo varieties. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
What, pray tell, do you wonder about? Ask us your questions, marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, a follow-up to our item a couple of days ago that Hasbro is going to start making Play-Doh in this country for the first time in a decade. I'm not sure how we missed this, but 2 weeks ago, the company filed for a patent on the way Play-Doh smells, to wit, and quoting, a unique scent formed through the combination of a sweet, slightly musky vanilla-like fragrance with slight overtones of cherry and the natural smell of a salted wheat-based dough, end of quote. And about that, you know, fair enough, but raise your hand if you remember how Play-Doh tastes, huh? All right, quitting time. The Dow Industrial is down below 21,000 again, off 51 points today. NASDAQ off 21 points, about a 3%. S&P 500 down 7, also about a 0.3%. Our daily production team on this radio program includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.